whose yellow flowers were marked with red drops, said to be caused by drops of the saint's blood falling on such a plant when he was martyred. The deed to the cottage was in Mr. Enrique's name, signed by my father. Once the business was set up, Mr. Enrique worked in my father's office as a clerk. He wore a black suit every day, which only served to show off how handsome he was. There were many women who wished to marry him, but he was a solitary person. The revolution on his island had scarred not only those who had fought in it, but also those who had abandoned their homeland. In the tax records, Mr. Enrique was said to belong to Moses Pommier, but he'd been granted his freedom on the dock in Saint-Domingue, where they traded a life for a life. My father told us that our people had been slaves in the desert, and because God had seen fit to set us free, none among us should ever own another man. It had been written that every man belonged to God and no one else. But did women belong to God or to the men of their family? They could not own property or businesses. Only their husbands could have that honor. They must lower their eyes, behave, follow their appointed destinies. My father now told me I must trust in him and do as I was told. Marriage is not unlike business, and business is something you're good at, my dear. He had finally arranged a marriage, as was the custom among our people, but I had never believed he would find a match for me. As soon as I heard that he had, a chill ran through me, even though he assured me he had chosen a good man, one who would treat me kindly. I must have paled, but before I could begin to mount my argument against the marriage, my father shook his head and took my hand in his. "Understand," he said gently, sadly, "it has already been agreed upon." I knew once he gave his promise there was no breaking his word. I could feel my pulse at the base of my throat. I heard the hummingbird outside the window, the whir and beat of its wings. The man my father had chosen was wise in the ways of business, but had recently had some bad turns of fortune with his ships. He had several decent ships left, and so he had come to my father, who had goods to sell, but no ships on which he could transport rum and molasses to Charleston and New York. Together they would join forces, and in this way they would both prosper. It was a partnership that would include the entire family, on the island and in Europe, as both businesses were co-owned by European relatives who had lent us money. A marriage would be a bridge between the two families, our wedding vows more binding than a legal contract. "It's a combining of strengths," my father told me. I said nothing, but I knew it was more. It was a combining of destinies. Our congregation was so small, there were only a few young men left unmarried. I assumed I would know the groom-to-be, but he was not one of the boys I had grown up with. When my father told me the name of my betrothed, I felt the way prisoners must when the cage that holds them is slammed shut and the key in the lock is turned. My husband-to-be was Isaac Petit, a man nearly 30 years my senior, the father of 3 children, the last a girl not yet a year old. It was the birth of this baby that had caused his wife to pass from our world. We had all gone to her funeral. I could not see Monsieur Petit from where I sat, but I had heard his children crying. The losses to the Petit family seemed beyond what humankind could bear. 7 children had died. A daughter, 1 son, and then another. 2 twin girls who passed from this world before they could be named. And finally, a beloved son named Joseph. Only 2 sons had survived, David and Samuel. And then, 12 days after the last baby girl was born, Madame Esther Petit, who had been suffering from childbed fever, passed away. I had seen her many times in the market square, a slim, pretty woman who had prized the red flower of the flamboyant tree. For days after her passing, people left vases of them outside her husband's house. They were all faded now, swept away. There was a lump in my throat when I heard my fate. I thought of the map of Paris that I had memorized in my childish book of stories hidden beneath my mattress. I imagined a man I didn't even know coming into my bed. I would rather be at the bottom of the sea, but I knew I must go forward. Perhaps someone else would have begged to be released from her father's promise, but I had seen the ledgers, and I knew that there would be no house, no garden, no comfortable life as we knew it if the business stayed the same. That was why Adele had seen an unexpected fate for me. I would be a mother before I was ever with a man or had given birth. My future was already waiting for me. The house of the red flowers, the motherless children who had wept, the sorrowful man who had paid so little attention to his business after his wife died that he'd nearly been ruined. On the night when moths twice as large as any in Paris struck against the wooden shutters, I knew this was not a dream that would be broken by morning light. I wanted nothing more than to leave St. Thomas and be sent off to Europe, even if it meant I must care for some aging relative or clean other people's homes. All the same, my father looked like an old man, beaten by fate. He was concerned for the future, but it was my future as well. "First, I will have a discussion with Monsieur Petit," I told my father. He sighed. He knew I was stubborn and had my reasons. "Must you? Must you breathe to live?" Wishing to save the business didn't make me a fool. "I won't deny what you ask, but in return don't deny me. Send him to me." Monsieur Petit came a few evenings later, after his children were asleep under the watchful eye of a maid. It was late enough for the mosquitoes that swarm at dusk to have disappeared into the damp night. The bats had settled into the trees, their shadows like leaves. I could hear them breathing as they hung upside down in the branches. I'd asked for the meeting to be informal, outside. All the same, my father introduced us formally, though surely we'd met before, although on what occasion neither of us could remember, for Monsieur Petit had been a grown man and I nothing more than a girl. "Enchanté," Monsieur Petit said to me. I'd been told that he'd come directly to St. Thomas from Paris, which interested me. I wished I might question him about his past there, but my father threw me a look, so I merely greeted our guest politely. The man had glasses of sherry. I had a tea of vervain, though I would have preferred rum. My mother insisted I wear one of her dresses so that I would look sophisticated, a bit older than my age. It was a gray silk frock from France, with an underskirt of crinoline that pricked at my legs as if ants were climbing past my ankles. My hair was pulled back with combs fashioned of tortoiseshell and abalone. I knew I wasn't beautiful, but I was young and perhaps that was enough. My father spoke about the weather, always a topic on an island prey to storms, and then they discussed business matters, nothing too urgent. What was central to the arrangement had already been addressed before the proposal of marriage was made in private. I asked Adele to find out as much as she could about Monsieur Petit from the maid who cared for his children. Because of this, I knew he was 44 years of age. Older than my father, more than double my own age. Earlier in the day, Justine had come into my room. She knew what was to be and didn't approve of arranged marriages. She gazed at the silk dress my mother had given me, then rubbed the heavy gray fabric between her fingers. "You shouldn't wear this," she advised. The weather was sweltering, and drops of water fell into the garden even though there was no rain. "This is why French women faint." "He's proposing tonight." I was gazing at myself in the mirror, and I didn't like what I saw. I thought I resembled my mother.
"You don't even know him. How can you marry him?" Justine asked.
"Marriage is no different from business," I told her. I was parroting my father, but I also believed I had a duty to him.
"It should be a business of the heart and soul."
Justine lowered her voice.
"We can run away and be gone before anyone notices we are missing. Let them find him another wife. We'll go to Paris."
We had always planned to journey there together, but now I shook my head. I couldn't allow my family to be financially ruined. It was the night when the turtles came to shore, but Justine went alone to the beach while I sat in the courtyard with the man I was to marry.
"Shall we speak to one another plainly?" I asked Monsieur Petit when there was a lull in this conversation with my father.
Adele had always told me that a woman who acts as if she knows what she's doing gets what she wants.
"And perhaps alone?"
Monsieur Petit glanced up, startled by my request.
He was tall, with distinctive features. His hair was marked with gray. I'm sure a woman of his age would have found him attractive. I smiled at him with whatever small charm I might have. "Surely my father can trust you to be alone with me?" Monsieur Petit nodded.
"If you wouldn't mind,"
he said to my father. He still had not addressed me directly.
"You're the one who might mind. She doesn't hold back her remarks."
My father glanced at me with an implicit warning. Once Monsieur Petit and I were left alone in the garden, the seriousness of the situation settled between us, a heavy weight. We were to marry, yet knew nothing of one another. We both gazed into the hedge of jasmine, embarrassed and ill at ease. The heat enveloped us. Justine had been right. The gray silk dress was much too heavy for this season. I wished I could tear it off and toss it into the shrubbery, then sit across from my fiancé in my white cotton chemise and petticoat so I might be more at ease. My mother had forced me to wear black stockings and calfskin boots with pearl buttons when I would have much preferred to be barefoot. I laughed to think of what Monsieur Petit's reaction might be, were he faced by an unruly girl who'd slipped out of her dress. When I laughed at my imagined state, he glanced at me confused, then studied the dark garden as if there was something to see in the hedges. The scent of jasmine and frangipani was dizzying, but I was used to it and kept my head. I grew braver and turned my attention to Monsieur Petit, searching his face for clues to his disposition, pleased when he looked up, then quickly looked away. My direct gaze had made him nervous. I took that to mean he would not bully me or tell me what to think. He turned to his glass of sherry as if it were the most compelling thing on earth. That was when I thought I might have the upper hand in the situation. Monsieur Petit politely asked about my interests. Another man wouldn't have cared. "I believe you're my interest now," I told him. "Do you wish to know me thoroughly before you make your decision?" he asked. "I wouldn't wish for you to be unhappy with the arrangement." It was then I realized this was as much a business affair for Monsieur Petit as it was for me. In that instant, I understood he still loved his wife. "My father speaks well of you. I don't need to know more. But if I am to be a mother, I wish to meet the children." "The children are very well behaved," Monsieur Petit assured me. I was cordial, but I made my point. "That's not the issue. If we are to be married, you need to trust my opinion, and that is, I must meet the children." His expression was puzzled, but he nodded. He had dark eyes and tanned skin. He'd spent a good deal of time on ships before he married and had children.
"Of course."
"There," I said. I could tell what happened between us would be up to me. We've had our first fight, and are none the worse for it. He seemed amused, and perhaps would have enjoyed further conversation, but I stood and shook his hand and told him good night. I did not wish for him to consider our meeting anything more than it was. He had a nice handshake. He did not try to overpower me, as some men might have, nor did he shrink from me. Most important, he didn't press me to account for my reasoning. In truth, I wasn't worried that something was wrong with the children. Rather, I feared that I might not be able to experience the emotion a mother should possess, due to my own fraught relationship with my mother. I knew from fairy tales about the evil deeds stepmothers might do, how black their hearts might turn. I had no idea what reaction I might have to another woman's children, especially the daughter who had caused her death. When the Petit's maid spoke with Adele, she had divulged that even on her mistress's deathbed, the ailing woman could think only of her newborn daughter. Madame was desperate to live long enough for the naming ceremony, 8 days after the birth. If a baby died without a name, the spirit of Lilith, she who preceded Eve, could come for that child's spirit and claim it as her own. Madame Petit chose the name Hannah, which meant grace. On the day after the naming, Madame was too weak to take a sip of water. She lasted 4 more days, but on the 12th day, she began to succumb to childbed illness.
"If you don't watch over her, I'll haunt you," she had whispered to her maid, frightening the woman so deeply she rarely let go of the child even now, all these months later.
She held the baby close all night, watching over her until morning, afraid not of Lilith, but of Madame Petite's ghost. The one thing that could make me walk away from this marriage bargain was if I felt nothing upon seeing the boys and the baby girl. To take care of a ghost's children, one could not feign love. On the day I went to the Petite house, I wore what I would have to wander through the hills with Justine. We favored plain cotton skirts that made it easy to run, in case we came upon some of the wild donkeys with nasty dispositions that might give chase, braying as they nipped at our legs. Justine came in while I was dressing. "If you join that family, you will know only tragedy," she told me. She had seen the boys in the market, and they looked ragged like little criminals, even though their housemaid treated them with special kindness. "All boys look like criminals until you wash their faces," I said. "No one could have looked more like a little thief than Aaron, and you certainly opened your heart to him." My cousin could be selfish and stubborn, but with Justine, he was tender, a different person completely. I believe he had fallen in love with her on those nights when we were the only people in the world. She returned his love, even though she knew no one of our faith could marry a woman of African heritage. Justine, although free, would never be recognized as one of our people. Still, Aaron was sullen if she went out with anyone else, whether it be with her mother or her cousins or lately even me. When men looked at her, as they always did, he was outraged. He'd gained a reputation as a hothead, someone to avoid. But while Justine had sleepless nights, Aaron slept quite well. I knew this because when I knocked on his door to tell him his breakfast was waiting, he didn't even bother to reply. I went in anyway and sat on the edge of the bed. "Do you love Justine?" I had asked one day. He was a handsome man, yet still a child in many ways. "Of course I do," he said. "But Madame can never hear of it."
"You're going to let Madame Pommier ruin your life?"
Aaron had pushed me off the bed.
"There are rules," he told me.
I was shocked to hear him say so. I thought of us as rebels, wandering the island, going where we pleased, even if it was something my mother had forbidden. "You're the one who will ruin your life if you don't understand there are differences among us," he told me. After that, I didn't trust Aaron. I told Justine 1,000 times, "Don't choose him." But she said in love there were no choices and swore one day I'd find that to be true. I could not concentrate on my books or on the stories I wrote anymore. I listened to the moth that always tried to get into my room, and I wished I could fly with it across the ocean. Perhaps in the cold my heart would freeze, and I would care nothing for those I was forced to abandon. My father escorted me to the Petite house on a Sunday afternoon when the church bells were ringing. There were mountains all around the town, and many of the streets were steep. One had to climb up staircases made of ballast stones from ships that had docked at the island, for thousands of such stones were unloaded when the shipmasters picked up their cargo. The Petite home was up a winding twist of a road. The house was pretty, painted yellow with a large veranda. There were green shutters at every window that could be fastened shut when there was a threat of a hurricane. Egrets were fishing in a small pond nearby, a sign of good luck despite Justine's warnings. Egrets meant joy and happiness. I knew that much. I asked my father to fetch Monsieur Petit while I waited at the gate. I needed a moment to collect my thoughts. "Go on," I said to my father. "It's fine for me to wait on my own."
"If you're this bossy with him, he'll likely cancel the wedding," my father warned. "If he doesn't try to please me now, what will he do when he's my husband?"
My father laughed, but he did as I asked. Standing there, I noticed egrets worked into the design of the iron fence. I wondered if Madame Petit had asked the iron worker for this pattern after watching the very birds I now spied in the pond. I didn't go forward until my father and Monsieur Petit came out. They were so much older I felt silly being young and inexperienced, but then I saw how tentative Monsieur Petit was and I felt my strength. I nodded a greeting, then asked if they would leave. In the bright light, Monsieur Petit looked worried and even older than he had on the evening we met.
"But you don't know the house."
"You plan on marrying me, yet you have discomfort about me being in your house? Do you think I'm a thief?"
he laughed.
Not at all. It's only that I wish to introduce you.
For your comfort.
I assured him that women spoke to children in ways men did not understand, or so Adele had always told me. I said I was comfortable on my own and he could return in 1 hour. That was time enough. In 1 hour I would discover all I needed to know.
And you don't have to watch over me, I teased my father. If anyone was to do that, it would be Monsieur Petit.
Isaac Petit looked startled. I think he was still in a dream, imagining that his wife might return to him. I saw that his posture was somewhat stooped, as if he carried sorrow on his back. All of this might have made another girl turn and run, but I had always been the sort of person to do my best no matter the situation. I went to the porch, where there was wicker furniture set out facing a long view of the harbor. The water was pale green in the shallows, turquoise in the deep. The sea changed color depending on the tides and the wind. I pried open the heavy mahogany door and slipped inside the house, where it was cooler, darkened against the summer heat with closed shutters and drawn curtains. Being inside was like drinking a glass of chilled water. I stood in the hallway and shivered, thankful to be cold. The boys were clearly expecting a guest, for they found me in the hall fast enough. They had dressed formally for the occasion in white shirts and black trousers, their hair combed back with lavender water. They raced in and looked disappointed when they spied me lingering there.
"We thought our new mother was coming," they burst out.
I could tell they thought I was a day woman, hired to help with the laundry. My clothes were plain and I was young. Not what they had expected.
"You can have but one mother in this world, and no one can take her place," I assured them.
When I asked for a tour, they showed me all the rooms they planned to show their new stepmother.
"Let's run," they said. "We're usually not allowed."
I laughed and chased them down the hall. I let them think I was the laundress. It was the best way to observe their true natures. The older boy, David, was outgoing and talkative. Samuel was the quieter one, who had green eyes the color of the sea. There was a sadness sifting through him. He seemed older than his age, which was less than 4, but I was soon reminded of how young he was. Sometime during the tour of the house, he took my hand quite naturally. The truth was, I liked the feel of his hand in mine, the heat and weight of it. The boys shared a room. The window opened to a stand of banana trees. From here it was possible to watch the bats at night, for those creatures love this kind of fruit, opening the peels with their hands as if they were small people. I sat with the children on the bed and heard David's stories of the bats he had seen, one that had red eyes, one that had pointed teeth, one as large as a cat that darted through the shadows to sit on the window ledge so it might peer inside the room licking its lips. Samuel crept into my lap during the story. He shivered and kicked his feet. I leaned down and said, "Your brother is making up these stories. If he saw a bat as big as a cat, it was indeed a cat. He was probably too sleepy to tell the difference." After that, Samuel seemed calmer. I thanked the boys for showing off the house.
"It's one of the prettiest on the island," I said.
"Our mother made it that way," Samuel told me. When he let go of my hand, I felt empty. They went off to play, and I continued along the corridor so I might glance into Monsieur Petit's room. It was very neat and clean, with a huge mahogany bed. There was white mosquito netting hanging down, held in place through a hook in the wooden rafters. The duvet was a pale mint green of very soft cotton. It seemed Monsieur Petit and his wife had slept together, for she hadn't her own bedroom, as many married women did, only the nursery next door. I peered inside. The room was dark, and I wondered if I would see Madame Petit's ghost if I reached out to her. For I knew I could call spirits to me so that they flickered over my palms. Because of this, I kept my hands closed. I suppose I was nervous about what she might say to me. What if she warned me away? What if she uttered a jealous curse? I found my way downstairs easily enough. I wanted to see what else I would discover in this house that held so much sorrow. Perhaps a sign that would tell me whether I should stay or go. In the parlor there was a small piano painted white. I ran my hands over the keys without making a sound. Then I listened to a bee tapping against the window, struggling to get inside. I could spy the sea from this room, as green as Samuel's eyes. Perhaps that was all the sign I needed. The maid was in the kitchen, the baby in her arms as she cooked a soup for lunch. I could smell curry and chicken gravy. The maid had set out Johnny cakes on a platter and was drinking a cup of steaming balsam bush tea. Hot food and hot weather, local people say. Such meals heat you up inside, and then when you finish and put them aside, you feel cooler. I recognized the maid from the market, an African woman named Rosalie, who had always lived with a petite family. Her accent was the same as ours, a rich Creole French. When she turned from the stove to see me standing there, she took a step away. The baby in her arms had golden hair and dark blue eyes, nearly violet in color. She waved her small hands at me. Perhaps this was another sign. "May I hold her?" I asked. The maid grasped onto her. "Maybe you're a spirit," she said uneasy. "I'm not. You know Adele, who works for us? I'm Moses Pommier's daughter." She wasn't convinced it was safe to have me in the house.
"You might have come to steal her."
"I didn't. I was invited to this house by Monsieur Petit."
"He didn't invite you to hold this child. As you can see, he's not here. I am. So it's my decision."
I understood that if a person made a pledge to a ghost, she would fear being haunted if she failed to keep her word. I would have to win them both over, the maid and the spirit of the mistress of this house. I gazed at the stove. There was a heavy cast-iron pot, and the fragrance of the food was unmistakable.
"Curried lime chicken soup. That's my favorite, I must say. I'd like your recipe." "I don't give my recipes to strangers."
By then we were speaking informally, as if we knew each other. "I'm not really a stranger." I picked up a wooden spoon from the table. "May I?" Rosalie shrugged, so I took a taste. I could never make a soup as good as this one. Indeed, it was very good. But my compliment got me only so far. Rosalie was still wary, so I told her the truth about my visit. "Monsieur Petit has asked to marry me."
She nodded. "I've heard so. Not that he mentioned it to me."
"I'll likely say yes."
"You're here due to love?"
We gazed at each other. I saw that very few lies could get past this woman. "Due to circumstance."
"Because he won't love you," Rosalie informed me. She was a straightforward woman, not yet 30.
"Just so you have that clear in your mind. That won't happen. He already loved someone." "Fine," I said. At that time I didn't care about love. I didn't even believe in it, since it had never affected me. Rosalie saw that I was studying Hannah. She was darling, so pretty she looked like a bluebell in a garden.
"She's a very good baby."
Rosalie shifted the child in her arms.
"Maybe you'll spoil her."
"I won't. You won't let me." Rosalie threw me a look. She knew what I meant. If I came to live here, I would keep her on. I would share the baby with her. She decided to let me hold Hannah. As soon as the child was in my arms, she gazed into my eyes as if we somehow knew each other.
"She doesn't like strangers," Rosalie said. "But she's taken to you."
I smoothed the baby's hair. I felt something close to my heart. "Do you think you can love someone who doesn't belong to you?" Rosalie nodded. "I know that you can." My hour in the petite house passed quickly. The sea had turned a darker green and pelicans wheeled across the sky. When I left, only Monsieur Petit was waiting at the gate. He looked appealing from a distance, and I noticed that his suit was more elegant than most, presumably tailored in France. There I was in my cotton skirt and blouse, my hair unbraided. I felt like a child beside him as we met and shook hands. Parrots in the treetops called when we went up the hill. It was another good sign to see parrots nearby. The Danish government had sent over mongooses to kill the many rats that made their home around the wharves, but since rats were nocturnal, the mongooses had turned on other prey, attacking our parrots. Now there were fewer than 100 left in the wild, mostly in the mountains, where the foliage was deep enough for them to hide from these predators. As we walked on, I realized that I no longer considered this to be a purely business arrangement. I felt dizzy and there was a lump in my throat. I had fallen in love. Not with Monsieur Petit, but with the children. We were silent as we strolled through town, unpracticed in the art of conversation with one another. When we reached my parents' house, Isaac Petit gently placed his hand on my arm. I didn't shrink from his touch as I'd imagined I would.
You didn't give your opinion of the children. Were they well behaved?
Very much so. The maid has done well with them.
You will too.
Children need a mother. I've already told them that children can only have one mother in this world. I would not dream to think I could take your wife's place. Monsieur Petit nodded. I saw his grief pass over his face.
You will do well all the same, he told me.
I want Rosalie to continue on.
Of course. She's always been with us, and you'll need help.
He was an agreeable man, more attractive than I'd first thought. No wonder my predecessor had fallen in love with him and slept in his bed rather than have a room of her own. Throughout my life, my mother hushed me whenever I tried to speak my mind. But if I kept silent now, I would never be able to be honest with this man. So I decided to say what another woman might keep to herself. When you think of the woman who is your wife, I will not expect you to think of me first, I told Monsieur Petit. He kissed me on both cheeks as a father might have. Justine would have been disappointed. She would have wanted him to kiss me on the mouth and place his hands on my waist and draw me near. But I was pleased and relieved. I was so young, I believed that, when it came to a marriage, there could be matters more essential than love.
So we have an agreement, I said.
He laughed and looked at me.
You would have been a good businesswoman.
But such a thing did not exist in our world, not unless it came to making a marriage that would benefit all concerned. I'll make a good wife, I assured him. One you won't have to love. Chapter 2 The Elixir of Life. Charlotte Amalia St. Thomas, 1818. Rachel Pommier Petit. Adele and Justine and I worked feverishly on my dress, sewing until our fingers bled. We used cornstarch to staunch the bleeding.
You may need this on your wedding night, Adele told me.
She explained how a woman bled the first time she was with her husband. She said this was natural, for a marriage was a blood pact. The wedding was in a matter of weeks. Adele had given me some information concerning what went on between men and women. The rest I discovered from watching donkeys in the fields and listening to the whispers of the pirates' wives.
You think he'll be like a donkey? Justine laughed at me. Why marry a man at all?
Both Justine and Adele thought I was making a mistake to do my father's bidding, but I didn't care to hear their opinions or warnings.
She doesn't want to talk about love, Justine told her mother with a grin. She wants to marry a donkey.
Just a man, I said. One who understands my father's business.
Maybe she's right, Adele shrugged, since she's not bound to know love in this marriage.
What was a husband, after all, if not a partner? Why should I ask for more than that? Why should I ever want it? Even if Justine would have agreed to attend my wedding service, my mother made it clear the ceremony was only for people of our faith. The marriage prayers were recited at the same altar where Monsieur Petit's wife's funeral had been held. The synagogue was a dark building, but when light came through the windows, it became a radiant place. My mother was pleased that I was to marry Monsieur Petit, and because she approved, she gave me her wedding veil, smuggled from Saint-Domingue, the only thing she'd taken other than her jewels.
You're not as foolish as I thought you were, she told me. I supposed it was a compliment.
Marry from here, she touched her head. Not here, she hit her chest. Love will do nothing for you.
As soon as she offered her approval, I began to doubt myself. If she thought something was right, it was usually wrong. But it was too late for me to have second thoughts. I'd given my father my word. On the day of the ceremony, I asked that branches from the flamboyant tree be placed in a vase on the altar to honor the first Madame Petite. Her husband would now be mine. He looked very somber and handsome and much too old for me. During the ceremony, the boys were solemn and quiet, and Hannah did not call out once. Everyone said she was an exceptional baby, calm and sweet-natured. The wedding contract, a lavishly illustrated document bordered by gold leaf, had been signed the evening before. Time moved quickly during the service. The synagogue was so close and crowded and hot. My mother beamed with pride, which gave me a case of nerves. I felt myself grow wobbly. I refused to faint, but my heart was so loud it was all I could hear. I concentrated on a vase of pink flowers at the altar, beside the branches of the flamboyant tree, placed there by Justine, who knew bougainvillea to be my favorite flower. And then it was done. I was a married woman. The marriage dinner was in the garden of my parents' house. Tables had been set out, and silvery lanterns were strung from the trees. Everyone was there, all of the old families from St. Croix and Saint-Domingue, and some of the newer families from Amsterdam and Morocco. My father's good friend, Monsieur de Leon, gave a speech in which he declared that every bride should have a father as wise and kind as mine. Though I agreed, I couldn't wait to get out of my heavy wedding dress, which Justine had already decided we would dye blue so I might get some use of it in the future. Justine now worked beside Adele as a maid in our house and had helped cook the food for the dinner, but on this night she came as a guest, invited by my father. She wore a pale pink taffeta dress. She and I both had our hair braided by Adele's deft hands. There were little white pearls scattered through my hair and pink pearls threaded through Justine's hair. People said we looked so alike we might have been sisters. I introduced her to Monsieur Petit, who took her hand and said it was a pleasure to meet such a dear friend of his wife's. Without thinking, I laughed when he called me his wife. It seemed like a joke, some wild mistake. Monsieur Petit crinkled his eyes when he smiled. He wasn't the least bit insulted. I carried Hannah in the crook of my arm during the party. The boys ate cake, and my father let them take sips of wine. When it grew late, I had to send the children home with Rosalie, even though Samuel held onto my skirt and said he was afraid of the bats his brother said perched on the window ledge. I whispered for him not to worry. When I get to the house, I'll take a broom and chase them away. The night was hot and long. I drank rum punch until I was dizzy. As the evening was ending, my mother took me aside. After all these years of disapproval and silence, she suddenly wanted to begin an intimate conversation concerning what went on between a husband and wife. I suppose she thought it was her obligation to do so. You may not like your husband's desires, but it is your duty to fulfill them, and in the end you'll become used to him. Do not fight him, and do not think he means to murder you when he takes you in his arms. I nearly laughed out loud.
Thank you, I said, but you don't need to say any more. My husband will instruct me. My mother gazed at me, eyes narrowed.
You're very sure of yourself.
Perhaps she thought I was experienced in matters of a physical nature. In fact, I wasn't, which was why I'd had so much rum. A carriage took us away. Usually a bride's carriage would be decorated with ribbons and flowers, but in deference to the first Madame Petite, ours was plain. The black carriage horse was the same one that had brought her coffin to the cemetery. I went upstairs relieved to take off my wedding clothes. Most people avoided a summer wedding, and now I understood why. It was too hot for the heavy clothes one had to wear for such an occasion. I was happy to be in my muslin undergarments, barefoot, my hair freed from the tight plaits that Adele had decorated with pearls. The little beads scattered onto the floor, and they sounded like falling rain. Though I had never spent the night here before, I had the sense of being at home. I peered into the nursery to watch Hannah sleep, then went to look in on the boys.
True enough, bats were perched on the window ledge.
In the morning, I would instruct Rosalie on how to place sharp shells and bits of broken glass along the casements to keep those creatures away. For now, I merely opened the window and shook a handkerchief until the night creatures flew to the treetops. When I turned, Monsieur Petit was there. I cared nothing for love, yet I was terrified of all I was yet to learn about my husband's desires. My mother had frightened me with her instructions. "We are married," my husband reminded me. I said I knew.
"What else do you know?"
He was gazing at me in a way he hadn't before. "Nothing," I admitted. I thought of Justine and Aaron and the way they were drawn to one another, even when they didn't wish to be. When I'd asked Justine to teach me all she knew about love, she'd declined. "If I told you, it would all sound silly or ugly, but when it's you, it will be different. You have to learn for yourself." Monsieur Petit brought me to bed and taught me what people did in the dark. He undressed me and I let him, though I had it in my head that I could escape into the baby's room at any time, turn the key and sleep on the floor. Monsieur put his hands on me and I let him do so. He told me he wouldn't hurt me, but everywhere he touched me I began to burn. He moved away from me to ask if I was all right. I nodded and waited for what came next. I found myself to be a bit disappointed. I'd had certain expectations, and Monsieur Petit didn't act in the manner I'd expected. I'd heard women in the market say that a man would become a beast of sorts, a slave to his desires. Certainly, my mother had prepared me for some sort of violence, which in a way interested me. I thought of Perrault's story of Bluebeard, who'd had so many wives, each one mad for him despite the ill treatment they received. Monsieur Petit, however, was quiet, possessing a tenderness I hadn't anticipated. He didn't rush anything between us, merely held me to him. I could feel the way he wanted me, and that was curious to me. It wasn't love, but he seemed to possess a sort of passion for me, perhaps a hunger he'd had since his wife had been gone. He had one hand on the small of my back, the other hand slipped between my legs. Who was I that I wanted this? I felt the heat spread out inside of me in a way I didn't understand. I could not think clearly. I believed I saw a shadow in the velvet chair against the wall. I could have sworn I heard a sigh from that area as well, a single breath. I moved away from Monsieur Petit and gazed in that direction. I had the sense that we were being watched, although aside from the two of us, the chamber appeared empty. "Is something wrong?" my husband asked me. I shook my head and closed my eyes. If the first Madame Petit was with us, that was her right. But it was also my right to ignore her. Before long, it seemed I had drifted out of my body, as if my spirit were flitting above us. I could watch myself on the bed below. I was inside a dream, but I could feel a stab of heat inside me. Perhaps I was shivering, as if I had flown away with a moth outside the window of my bedchamber, a place where I would never sleep again. Monsieur Petit said again that if I liked, he could wait for me to become more used to him, but I said no. We were married, and because this was our wedding night, I asked if on this single occasion he would think only of me rather than of his first wife. I would never ask this of him again, and when he did call me Esther on other occasions, I never once complained. There was so much to learn about the children and the household in the first weeks. I might have easily become overwhelmed, but I had Rosalie to educate me, and she was a good teacher. She told me she had been born in this country, on the grounds of one of the old Danish farms, and that she had been cooking since she was a little girl. I stood beside her in the kitchen, both of us in our aprons, our hair covered by scarves. I learned the recipes for lime chicken soup and for all her other dishes. I soon became expert in cooking the children's favorite food, the fungi porridge of cornmeal with vegetables that I myself had always enjoyed. The children's play in the muddy garden made for masses of laundry, which were hung out on two rope lines nearly every day. The clean clothes smelled like sea air, and before Rosalie pressed them with a heavy iron, she sprinkled them with lavender water. David was already attending the school at the synagogue, but Samuel followed me around from room to room. I allowed the children to stay up late, for I hated to discipline them. Often, Monsieur Petit read in the drawing room while I played games with the boys.
"You worried you wouldn't love them. Now I'm worried that you love them too much," Rosalie warned.
"There's no such thing," I laughed. But Rosalie said I was wrong. We sat on the porch and drank ginger tea. In a low voice, she told me she'd had a baby who had died. She had loved him too much, and so she took his death as a punishment from God for being too proud. The baby spit up blood and turned so hot he was on fire in her arms. The milk he drew from her breast boiled in his mouth, and perhaps that was what killed him, she whispered. His own mother's milk. She was crying as she spoke. The wound was that fresh, even though the baby had been gone for several years. I slipped my arms around her and insisted that neither her God nor mine would be so cruel as to do such a thing. A baby could not drown from drinking milk. He'd clearly had yellow fever, and that was no one's fault. I was young and thought I understood grief, but I knew nothing. I had no idea of how deep a mother's sorrow could be. Rosalie was polite enough not to tell me I was a fool to give her advice. I think she pitied my stupidity and saw it as innocence, so she embraced me in return and said nothing more. But after that, I often heard her crying behind the stairs, and knew it was for the baby she had loved too much. The women from the congregation invited me to join them as a member of Blessings in Peace and Loving Deeds. This was an honor, and in my mind, both unexpected and unwanted. All the same, I had little choice. Monsieur Petit was an esteemed member of the community, and I was his wife. At last, my mother could be proud as I sat among the women from the best families. I overheard her speaking of me. At first I thought she was referring to my predecessor, but no. When she had said Madame Petit, whose house was so lovely, whose children were so well-behaved, I realized she meant me. After tea, at Madame Halevy's home, there was conversation regarding orphan children and those of our faith who did not have luck with business or had fallen prey to illness. We planned dinners to raise funds for those in need and wrote up reports to present to all of the committee members. People who faltered were discussed at great length, for in a group such as this, any hint of wickedness was worth uncovering, including those men who dared to keep two wives, a Jewish wife and another wife, and perhaps another family living near the docks. The scandal concerned Nathan Levy, born in Baltimore, but now a resident of Charlotte Amalia. Levy had been granted the honor of being the United States consul, but was said to be dishonorable in his business dealings. The women seemed most concerned that he lived with an African woman named Sandrine, flaunting the relationship in public, treating her as though she were his wife. I'd seen them once when I was at the market with Adele. She had stared after them, interested. "My mother says it's the marriage of a heron and a parrot," I said to Adele.
"Does she?" Adele made a disapproving face. "Well, your mother knows nothing. They're not birds. They're people in love."
Levy was a member of our congregation, and although there were several letters sent to the office of the United States Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, in Washington, no one dared to discuss this matter with Levy face to face, for he was a man of power who helped the business interests of those on the island. Rather than confront him, people crossed the street when they saw his woman or when she and Levy walked arm in arm near the harbor. I went directly to Adele's house and found Justine on the porch folding laundry. "I thought you were too busy being married to come see me," she said. "Aren't you attending a meeting today?"
"I have three children, and I left the meeting."
I thought perhaps I would find excuses not to attend any meetings to come. Justine threw me a dark look. "You have one true friend," she reminded me.
"Whereas you have two," I teased. "How is Aaron?"
Justine laughed, a catch in her voice. "I haven't any idea." She said he had been avoiding her. Twice he had not shown up at their appointed meeting place. She'd stood alone in our garden. She'd thrown stones at my cousin's window, but there had been no response. "He's a heavy sleeper," I told her. "And you know as well as I do, he's lazy.
It was, to be honest, part of his charm. He liked to take his time and have lengthy conversations with other businessmen, rather than work in our father's shop, which he clearly thought beneath him. Justine shook her head.
I think someone's turned him against me.
We both knew who that someone was likely to be. My mother.
We should have never let him come with us, I said to my friend. We should have left him home when he begged to follow us. He was always a troublemaker.
No, he wasn't. Justine stacked the laundry neatly in a reed basket. We inherited our troubles. After the laundry was completed, we went into the hills the way we used to before I was married. Justine was right. I'd been consumed with my new duties and hadn't been a good friend. In truth, I'd missed her. We linked arms and chattered until there was a burst of rain, and then we had to run to take cover. When the torrents ended, a pale drizzle came down around us. Everything smelled green and sweet. On this island there were 100 varieties of rain, from blue to clear, from whirlwind storms to a dash of dew to the driving rain of winter. We used banana leaves as umbrellas and sat under the canopy of the trees. On very clear days, we could see the islands that were used as pastures, Goat Island and Water Island, where livestock ran free, chewing the wet, salty grass. Light drifted through the raindrops and the sky broke into colors. The heat came back, and we lay down in the field. We made garlands out of tall grass and bits of twig. No one passing by would have seen us, except that the grass moved whenever we breathed.
"Have you learned to love Monsieur Petit?" Justine asked me.
"I don't hate him."
She laughed and shook her head. "That isn't an answer. I told you not to do it. He's old enough to be your father."
"He's not my father when we're alone."
"Oh," she smiled. "So now you know. But is it good with him in bed? Do you long for him to touch you, yearn for him when he's not there?"
I shrugged as if I were an old married woman, though I was little more than 20.
"It's better than I thought it would be."
Justine snorted. "Because you thought it would be hell."
I was surprised to find I was insulted on my husband's behalf. Although I didn't love him, I respected him, and surely that counted for something. Another woman would have thought him a considerate lover, but I had been inflamed by the stories I'd read and the passions of Solomon, and I wanted more.
"I could not ask for a kinder man. That can't be hell."
But Justine knew me and could see this wasn't love. "There are those who say that heaven and hell are not so far apart. They are not at opposite ends of the world beyond ours, only a step away from one another." Every Friday night we had dinner with my family. I brought Rosalie along so she could watch over the children if they fell asleep, but also because I had made her a promise which I intended to keep. I would never let Rosalie go, even though my mother had instructed me to dismiss her and get a new maid, one who hadn't been loyal to the first Madame Petit. I smiled and nodded, but did the opposite. I gave Rosalie extra spending money, Saturdays and Sundays free, and warned her to stay away from my mother on Friday nights.
"I'm happy to do that," Rosalie said.
I grinned. If only I could do the same. All of the men in the family were now partners, members of the Burghers Association, for tradesmen must be accepted by the Royal Danish Organization in order to do business on our island. The marriage had strengthened the business, although Aaron Rodriguez wasn't happy to have Isaac Petit rise above him in a single day. My husband was a full partner, Aaron merely a distant cousin, whose official title was manager, which couldn't have pleased him. I knew that he and my father had been meeting to discuss the future, and on several occasions I had heard my cousin slam out of the house, grumbling under his breath, striking the gate with a stick on his way. I had heard my parents arguing in the parlor.
"There are ways around this," my mother said. "So you can keep him here and baby him while you treat him like a son?"
"Why not? He is a son to me."
"And what will his child be to you?" my father asked.
"What is yours to you?" my mother said coldly.
This was dangerous territory, I thought, even though I wasn't certain what my mother's meaning was.
"Am I not married to you still?"
my father said, which ended the conversation. That evening at dinner, my father revealed that Aaron was being sent to France.
My mother looked like she'd been crying, and my cousin did not look pleased by the announcement. All at once I viewed him differently. There was a hidden vulnerability inside him that was in direct opposition to the careless man he appeared to be. I suppose he thought he would be my father's heir, and now it was clear that honor had gone to my new husband, in the manner of the law if the oldest child was a girl, for women had no rights to property. It was a slap to Aaron, a reminder that he was not a true son, though my mother treated him as such. Yet he was not to be entirely forsaken. We had distant cousins in France, and many business connections, and Paris could not get enough of the island's rum. Aaron would be introduced to all of our relations and their friends. I felt a bitterness rise inside me. I was the one who wanted to go to Paris. Adele always said if a person doesn't speak her mind, she will carry her resentment until it burns her, as I was burning now. Perhaps we should be the ones sent to France, I said to my husband. There was an immediate hush of the dinner table chatter. My father and husband both looked at me as if I were a bee with a stinger who had settled on our table without invitation. That wouldn't be possible, Isaac said to me. He looked over at my father, embarrassed by my outburst.
And why not?
I had already convinced myself. Now all I had to do was convince the men of my family. The children would be in a good school and would get to know our family. It would be an adventure for them, and we could take Rosalie. My husband shook his head. Our life is here. Still, I didn't give up. You came from Paris. It would be a homecoming. My father's gaze was blistering. He didn't like to be disrespected, and this was the first time I had opposed his wishes.
You've said enough, he told me.
Your husband is an excellent partner, and the business here is what matters most. A business you clearly don't need me for. Aaron threw his napkin onto the table and stormed out.
Let him go, my father told my mother when she began to rise from her chair.
She sank back down near tears.
This day was bound to come, my father told her. You have done more than enough for that boy.
We will follow the law. The business will belong to Monsieur Petit, not to Aaron. I couldn't keep quiet. Even if I want to leave and he doesn't, if the business is to be my husband's, do I not also have a say?
My apologies for her behavior, my husband said to my father, as if I were a child he had to make excuses for.
He turned to me, displeased. Say no more. He looked his age on this night, and I could see he thought me nothing more than an ill-mannered girl, too young and foolish to know enough to hold my tongue. I thought of what Justine had said, that we had inherited our troubles. Certainly I had inherited mine. This marriage, this man, this house, this family.
I'll find my own way home, I told Isaac. I'll go with Rosalie.
I left the table and followed Aaron outside. Once he had been my baby cousin, a fondling in desperate need. Now he was a handsome man who stood alone, tossing some crumbs to the old lizard that had been his pet when he was a boy. He had only just turned 20. He was a favorite with many of the young women in our congregation, but he'd never looked at anyone other than Justine.
I should be the one going to France, I told him.
I wish it could be so. I'd be happy to stay here.
Then let me go, I said impulsively. I have no power, Rachel. Not even over my own life.
At least you'll get what you want. Someday your husband will take you there.
I plan to go with Justine, I told him coldly.
Aaron laughed at what a fool I was. You think you're so smart, but you don't understand anything.
You're never going there with her, just as I would never be allowed to marry her. Don't you understand she's the reason I'm being sent away? I felt ill. Perhaps the weather was too hot. I left my cousin and rushed along the stone path, past the fruit trees. The bananas were ripening and wasps were gathering, drawn to the sticky sugar inside the leaves. I didn't make it into the house, but instead was sick in the bushes, bringing up my dinner. Afterward, I sat back on my heels in the grass. Rosalie had come outside to search for me, and when she saw me, she went to the well. She came to hand me a cup of water.
You know what this means, she said. All at once I did. I thought of the nights in bed with my husband, and of the first Madame Petite, who had died of childbed fever.